Against the woman's boundless heart, arose the almighty cry of universal death. Hast thou got wings or feet that tread my stars? Frail creature with the courage that has sparked, the quickening without bounds of thought, the mortal hope, I'll escape from the plastic of your grief, clasping in thy heart thy fate into with those departing feet, if each a man is just.
Marie-Ange will come. Cushions. Cushions. Couple of cushions. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
We're reading in Book 9, the Book of Eternal Night. We've come to the second canto. We're on page 586, and we stopped at line 165, which is towards the bottom of the page. Savitri has emerged from that abysmal loneliness, that blindness in which she had lost sight completely of Satyavan. She's become aware again. But nevertheless, they continue their journey into the blackness. And death is telling her that this is my silent, dark immensity. This is the home of everlasting night. This is the secrecy of nothingness, entombing the vanity of life's desires. And he says, have you seen your source? This darkness is where you come from, and you are just a dream. You have no real existence. See this world of mine. Can you still go on hoping to last and to love? Savitri doesn't answer. But within herself, she resists what he's saying. No? She knows her source, the undying fountains of her life. She knew herself eternal without birth. But death continues. He says, you have survived this unborn void, this emptiness, which never shall forgive while time endures the primal violence that fashioned thought, forcing the immobile vast to suffer and live. For him, he expresses that this whole manifestation is a terrible violation, something which should not have happened. And he tells her, you have only won this sorrowful victory that you will be able to go on living for a little while without Satyavan. The ancient goddess is supporting you, protecting you, but what can she give to you? She's just prolonging this nothing that you dream is existence. She's just delaying with the labor of living thy eternal sleep. That's where we stopped. And now Death is going to express his view of what human beings are. Yeah. Larry, would you start? Line 166.
A fragile miracle of thinking clay, armed with illusions, walks the child of time. To fill the void around, he feels and dreads. The void he came from and to which he goes, he magnifies his self and names it God. He calls the heavens to help his suffering hopes. He sees above him with a longing heart, bare spaces more unconscious than himself, that have not even his privilege of mind, and empty of all but their unreal blue, and peoples them with bright and merciful powers. For the sea roars around him, and earth quakes beneath his steps, and fire is at his doors, and death prowls, baying through the woods of life.
Thank you. Oh, maybe you should read the next two lines, Larry, sorry.
Moved by the presences with which he yearns, he offers in implacable shrines his soul and clothes all with the beauty of his dreams.
Yes. This is the child of time, armed with illusions. That's us. So this is Death speaking. This is not Sri Aurobindo's view. This is not Savitri's view. Should not be our view. But there are many human beings who think this, no? That all these dreams of a higher existence, of higher presences, this is just illusions that we arm ourselves with to protect us against the challenges that the universe is always presenting us with. But still, it's so beautifully expressed. A fragile miracle of thinking clay, armed with illusions, walks the child of time.
Capitalized presences?
Yes.
Because that's our journey.
Actually, here, death makes one of his little shifts. He's been saying all these things are illusions, but now he's going to say that there are really presences and powers.
Yeah.
And the signal is that capital P.
Yeah.
Thank you, Audrey.
This is similar to Mayavada, you know, this illusionism, Ramakrishna.
It comes in many different forms, also in the materialist form, the skeptics, the realists.
Atheists.
Yeah.
So Mayavada also took some different forms.
Yes. Yeah, and we will find death adopting the arguments of all these different sets of deniers. Yes, Don.
Yeah, I'm very, very, very puzzled with this. Perhaps most of us are yet. It seems that death is trying to tell her a story that she should believe, but he actually knows the truth that she doesn't want to tell her or can't tell her, or does he think he should tell her?
Could you speak slow that he can follow?
I'm not quite understanding you, Don.
Okay. What I'm trying to say is that death is trying to tell Savitri a story that he would like her to believe.
Yes.
When actually the truth is something else, and he's trying to hope that she doesn't get there to the truth.
Yes, he is trying to discourage her. What he wants is for her to drop this demand for the return of living Satyavan. He's going to discourage her in every possible way he can, quite unscrupulously, regardless. Any argument will do. No? So that's very, very interesting. That gives Sri Aurobindo the possibility to share with us all the different arguments against the truth that Savitri stands for, and which will, at the end of the poem, triumph. and we hope at the end of the evolutionary process it will.
Sorry for speaking too quickly.
But nevertheless, what he's saying is a kind of view that is quite current in human thinking. That if we think about the divine or higher powers, that these are just projections of ourself, no? To fill the void, this emptiness, we don't know where we came from, we don't know where we are going to, so we imagine, we magnify something, some aspect of ourself, and we put the label God. That's what God is. No?
Since childhood, all the arguments that I have listened around myself, oh, that's the only thing that you get in life. Eat well, go holidays, it's nothing else. I mean, let's say, I was brought up listening all these things around. Some exceptions,
Most.
But most of the people say, well.
Perhaps in India, it's not like that.
Yeah, in India, people in Latin America, not, but the Europeans, I mean, that's what they think.
But in India, Dr. Nadkarni very often used to remind us, he said that the instinct of every Indian, he said it's coded into his Indian genes, is all this is an illusion, get out of it. So this was not Sri Aurobindo's view, and he's in many, many ways trying to share his much more affirmative view with us. So this is the colloquy, the conversation which is going on. All the negations are being presented, and through Savitri, Sri Aurobindo is giving all his answers.
So that we are prepared for the opposition.
Yes, exactly. When the opposition comes, we won't be convinced by it.
No.
And of course, Savitri has the immense advantage that through her yoga, described in Book 7, she has actually experienced the other truth. It's not just she's read it in a book and she believes it. It's not that she's received it from a guru. She's had the experience of her eternal existence and the truth of the living presence of the divine at work constantly in the universe. This is described in Canto 6 and 7 of the Book of Yoga. But nevertheless, it's very human for us, with all the difficulties we have facing every day, that we want, they call the heavens above to help our suffering hearts. We do it every day, we can't help us. And of course, we look up and we see this bare spaces, more unconscious than we are ourselves. They don't even have our privilege of conscious mind. They are empty, apart from this blue, love, beautiful blue, but unreal blue. It's not really blue, it's just the way we see it. No? But we think, oh, up there, there are bright and merciful powers. No? And we need to think that because of all the dangers. The sea roars around us, and earthquakes, and fire is at the door, and death prowls, baying through the woods of life, as if death is a wolf baying. That is what a wolf does, or a wolf pack does. They prowl. And this image of life as a forest, the forest of the thousand things. This is an ancient image for life. So this forest is full of dangers for we weak, helpless human beings. And so he says, man offers in implacable shrines his soul. We make this soul offering, but death says, there's nobody there for you to please with your prayers, nothing like that. No. But man also does this amazing thing of clothing with beauty, with the beauty of his dreams. Closing everything with the beauty of his dream. That's a wonderful thing about human beings. And actually, we can only do it because what death says is not true. We are carrying within ourselves some deep knowledge, that clothes everything with the beauty of our dreams, gives us faith, courage, impels us to go on living and facing the challenges of life. But now he's going to speak about the gods, the cosmic powers. Margaret.
The gods who watch the earth with sleepless eyes and guide its giant stumblings through the void have given to man the burden of his mind. In his unwilling heart, they have lit their fires and sown in it incurable unrest. His mind is a hunter upon tracks unknown, amusing time with vain discovery. He deepens with thought the mystery of his fate and turns to song his laughter and his tears. His mortality waxing with immortal's dreams, trembling his transience with the infinite's breath. They gave him hungers which no food can fill. He is the cattle of the Shepherd gods. His body, the tether with which he is tied, the cask for fodder, grief and hope and joy. His pasture ground they have fenced with ignorance. Into his fragile, undefended breath they have pressed a courage that is met by death. They have given a wisdom that is mocked by night. They have traced a journey that foresees no goal.
Thank you. There's a change, isn't there? in this part here, it's as if he is blaming the gods, the cosmic powers, and in that context, man is not anymore just armed with illusions. He seems to be really some kind of tragic hero, and all the cosmic odds are stacked against him, but still he's carrying this courage and this urge for wisdom. Anybody would like to ask anything about this quite long passage? Yes. Yes. This whole sentence goes together. This is a Vedic idea that human beings are like the cattle, the cows, the animals of the gods. Perhaps not so much cows as goats or sheep or something. Goats, I suppose. And how are we tied to this cosmic field? It's our physical body that keeps us tied to it. No? And they feed us. The gods feed us. They cast for fodder. Fodder is animal food. No? They give us grief and hope and joy. Perhaps these are the things that keep us going, actually. And they've limited the area where we can move and feed. They've fenced it round with the ignorance, all the things that we don't know and can't know. We find several references to this Vedic idea in the poem, and one aspect of the idea is that the soul, the higher being, is tied here by the body and the mind and the life, a triple cord. If we want to be free, we have to somehow undo the three cords of body, life, mind. They have given him, or they gave him, hungers which no food can fill. It's such a marvelous suggestive line. These are the hungers of our immortal part. No physical food can fill that. Yes, within us we are carrying some kind of wisdom, some kind of intuitive knowledge, but the darkness of the inconscience denies, just as death is denying Savitri's knowledge.
Yeah, one more thing. Troubling is transience with infinite breath. What is troubling the transience?
Yes, the breath of life, that is troubling us. It's always driving us forwards. It won't leave us in peace. We are transient beings. We won't last long. And we have that, somehow that feeling, that there's certain things we have to do while we are here.
No, they're troubling the gods, that means.
The gods are troubling man's transience, yes.
I mean, it's beautiful, this infinite breath.
Yes, the life, the limitless life breath of the Supreme. They breathe that into us. That's why we can never be at peace or at rest. There's always something driving us on. And it seems so unfair. We would like to sleep and to rest and fall back. No?
Well, he can say terrible things in such a poetic way. It's amazing.
And he even seems to pay tribute to human beings. No? Humanity. Man deepens with thought the mystery of his fate. He wants to, he, He makes an effort to know and turns to song his laughter and his tears. Music is one of the wonderful expressions of our higher being, our non-physical being. Our laughter and our tears, they get turned into poetry and to song and dramas and wonderful art.
Who hasn't felt the burden of his mind?
Yes.
And then the next sentence says, have given to man the burden of his mind, in his unwilling heart they have lit their fire and sown incurable unrest. So that is where
it's all coming from. The fires of aspiration, of will for something else. They've put all that in human beings. So we're not only a fragile miracle of thinking clay. There's something more there. It's as if, in spite of himself, death has to acknowledge this. Yes, Don.
I personally feel one line which hasn't seemed not to be mentioned but fits in with this, line 205, scourged like a beast.
You've run a little bit ahead, Don. We didn't read that yet.
But it hits.
That we stopped at the line, they, the gods, have traced a journey that foresees no goal. We have to keep traveling, but we don't know where we are going. And we may not be going anywhere. There may not be any goal. We may be going round and round in circles.
Especially because we are fancy and ignorant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The bottom of the God's will, like traveling, but the heart and mind, what is he saying? Between heart and mind and gods. Gods are revealed to him mind.
Yes.
And troubled and in his unwilling heart. That part is needs
yes.
a revelation.
So he started out by saying that we're just made of clay.
Yeah.
But strangely enough, this clay is conscious. So this means that there are universal powers. There's something in the manifestation that has given us not only a body, but a life which has all kinds of drives and impulses and desires and intentions and wishes, and a mind which tries to understand. And all this is troubling our transience. We cannot be at peace because the gods have lit these kind of fires in us. We never asked for it.
No.
Or perhaps we did.
Yeah, we did.
At least the material part of us is really troubled by all this. It thinks, no, let me go back to sleep.
To the question was brought here about the unwilling heart, I just read from a quotation from Sri Aurobindo that he said, even if you are very far developed, then in the heart will always, there are parts to transform in the heart. So that I found quite interesting, that it's not finished with the heart.
So shall we read on the next bit? Tuan. Sorry, now I've got these two people completely mixed up. Tuan, please would you read it?
Aimless man toils in an uncertain world, though by inconstant passes all his pain, scorched like a beast by the infinite desire, bound to the chariot of the dreadful gods. But if thou still canst hope and still wouldst love, return to thy body's shell, thy tie to earth, and lift thy heart's little remnant. Trying to live. Hope not to win back to be Satya. my strength deserves no trivial crown. Gifts I can give to soothe thy wounded love.
Wounded, yeah.
The pacts which transient beings make with faith, and the wayside sweetness earthbound hearts would love. These, if thy will accepts, may freely die. Choose of life's hopes for thy deceiving promise.
Thank you. So he sums up his argument. Man toils. It's typical of human beings that we have to toil. But it's all aimless. We may think we have aims, but he says these aims don't exist or are illusory or don't lead anywhere. What keeps us going partly is this lulling. Lulling is what we do to a baby. We put it to sleep. So we get soothed by some inconstant pauses of his pain. He's also not only lulled, but he's scourged. He gets beaten like a beast, like the bullock. It's the infinite desire that is driving us. And we are bound, we are tied to the chariot of the dreadful gods. They scourge us, they keep us going. We are pulling them along, almost, the image suggests. No? They wouldn't move forward if it were not for our efforts. But now he's going to offer her something. If you can still hope, and if you still want to go on loving, then go back to the earth, back to your body. And with whatever's left of your heart, try to live. Don't think that you're going to get Satyavan back. No. But you have some strength. I have to acknowledge that. Yes. This is the other aspect of death. He is Yama. He is the god of justice who keeps things in their place. He has to obey that law. So she has shown that she deserves something. So he says, your strength deserves no trivial crown. You can get something worthwhile, no trivial crown. I can give gifts to soothe your wounded life, to make it more pleasant. So if you will accept the kind of things that transient human beings make with fate, that they say, yes, that's good enough, give me that. No. The wayside sweetness that earthbound hearts would like to pluck as they go along the road of life. By the wayside, one may gather some beautiful experiences. These, if thy will accepts, make freely thine. You can have whatever you want. Choose a life's hopes. He specifies what she must choose. The hopes of a life for thy prize. And he says, it's a deceiving prize.
Yeah.
But this is what I can give you. Yes, Lorraine. Yes.
And the alchemy of the contradiction that one, because that's the pyramid thing in our history of coming to a third something.
Yes.
Out of that contradiction.
Yes.
So the fires of that hellish hell, and that in the end you can reach the pinnacle.
Yes. Yes, it's a good image,
yeah,
of what's going on, really. But death's mission is to make it go as slowly as possible, to offer as much resistance as possible, so that the thing is really one, that it's not a fake, it's not a pretense, a simulacrum. It has to be the real thing.
Every bit of you is that physical body.
And every bit of resistance has to be overcome. That's the labor of evolution. Thank you.
Can you bow to the chariot of the grateful God? Okay, as one perspective, I see that. But where is death in that?
I suppose if we want to be extremely subtle, we would say that he's in the chariot. He too must change.
Yeah.
And we see him change. Yeah. We will see him change.
Yeah.
It's been a long
time. So in a sense, he's identifying with her.
Yes.
Why don't you wait and see?
No, but it's already there, no?
Yeah.
He's also one of the gods. He's one of these cosmic powers. Yes.
That's my heart. He's pushing me.
Yeah.
And resisting that. No, that's why I
ask the question. Shalvan, I have a feeling, I don't know if the other could feel that, but I always, when I listen to death and all that, I remember the story of Jesus and the one that has to treat him. The disciple, what's the name of the disciple that...
You mean Judas?
Yeah. Judas has played a role. I mean, he was needed for the full story. And I think that death is also needed. Like, things always come to me that Judas was not a bad guy. And also the death also
well, he
played
had
a role necessary for the other. That, always, I want to share that. It's very powerful. Since I'm reading
this. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a drama,
yeah,
no?
There
wouldn't be a star story.
Jesus was not killed, and that's the same. Mm-hmm.
Rosa.
Again.
This is very special passage.
Yeah.
Now, what comes next? Ruthless.
I walk.
Yes, so there it stops. Conscious of immortality, I walk. He's offering her something. What is she going to reply? She's not going to ask anything just like that. This is the first time he's offered her something, I think, no? This is the first boon. So it's as if her vast heart is like an ocean, and crossing that ocean are beautiful moonlit ripples or waves. No? These are thoughts born out of silence. They're crossing the sea of her dumb, fathomless heart, her heart that is bottomlessly deep and profound. And finally she speaks. Her voice was heard by night. Sorry? Dumb. I think it is this idea of silence. No. Sri Aurobindo again and again refers to the silence and the strength of Savitri. And he's just used silence in the previous line. So dumb it is. Sometimes he says mute. Dumb. The heart doesn't actually speak, but there's this movement. And it comes out finally when her voice is spoken by night. And she says, I bow not to thee, O huge mask of death. So she sees him as unreal. Or at least this appearance he's putting on. And she says, you're a falsehood. You're a black lie of night. And you're just put there to frighten the cowed heart of human beings. Cowed, somebody who's frightened. You're unreal. Okay, you're inescapable, but you are unreal. Inescapable end of things. You're just a bad joke. Thou grim jest. Grim, it is cruel and with some very dreadful kind of humor. That's being played on the immortal spirit, because for the immortal spirit, death doesn't exist. You put on this mask and you play this part, as Anandi said. And maybe you're inescapable in the cosmic play, but I walk conscious of immortality. So he can't deceive her with his mask and his jest, his joke, his pretense. This is Savitri completely different from the Savitri of the traditional legend. We don't need to go into it much now, but in the traditional story, very humbly and politely she speaks. And it's that politeness and humility and the correctness of what she says that finally wins him over. Sri Aurobindo's Savitri is showing much more strength and courage and defiance. Amitod, she will read. Well, you can repeat this wonderful line.
Conscious of immortality, I walk. A victor spirit, conscious of my force. Not as a sublime to thy gates I came. Unseen, I have survived the clutch of night. My first strong grief moves not my secret mind. My unwept tears have turned to folds of strength. I have transformed my ancient, brittle clay into the hardness of a statue soul. Now is the resting of the splendid gods. My spirit shall be obstinate and strong against the vast refuses of the world. I stoop not with the subject mob of mine, who run the gleam with ego-satisfied hands, and pick from its smile with many trampling feet. Its scornful small concessions to the weak. Mine is the labor of the battling gods in pausing and the slow reluctant ear, the flaming will that reigns beyond the stars. They lay the law of mind on matter's words and wring the soul's wish from the earth's inconscient force. First I demand what a husband, waking in the forest charm, out of his long pure childhood's lonely dreams, desire and have not for her beautiful life. Give if thou must, or if thou canst refuse.
Thank you. A suppliant is somebody who comes begging. A suppliant who comes. Give me something, please. He says, not as a suppliant to thy gates I came. I'm coming as a victor spirit, unslain. Sri Aurobindo would like us to become like this. To be obstinate and strong against the vast refusal of the world.
So our dealings with the God is going to be different than the others.
Yes. Yes. So it is the ordinary, uneducated mob of minds who are ready, if anybody throws coins in the street, they will run and grab them, no? They run to glean with eager, satisfied hands if they get some little something, no? Pick from the mire, from the mud, with many trampling feet, the scornful small concessions which the world gives to the weak. You can have something after all. She says, I am not one of those. I belong to those battling gods, or I identify with and I fight with those battling gods who are imposing on the slow, reluctant years the flaming will that reigns beyond the stars, beyond all this material universe that we see. There's another realm of will, and the eternal will that has brought all this into existence. It's a process, it's been chosen like that, a process. Time is spreading all this out. Space is spreading all this out. This will is being individualized in so many separate beings. But that's the labor that I'm participating in. Imposing on the slow, reluctant years that flaming will that reigns beyond the stars. So what those gods are doing is imposing the law of mind on matter, winning the soul's wish from earth's inconscient force. This is the great adventure that the mother talks about and has invited us to participate in. So he asked her to choose a life's hopes. So she says, whatever Satyavan wished for, whatever hopes he had and didn't receive during his lifetime, give me those, if you must. And if you can, don't. If you are able to refuse. So she's not begging. She's not even accepting a gift. She says, I demand first. This is my first demand. What does she ask? Whatever Satyavan wanted. I don't know whether she knows, but death knows. And it's very important, this first gift that he gives in the symbolism of the poem. Audrey, would you read?
So, can I ask a question?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, why is the labor of the back end gone? Mm. She's one of those back end gods.
She's even one of the original gods,
yeah.
We are told at the beginning, no?
Yeah.
And she's backing the victory party. The
right.
Yes.
Yeah. The statistics are important.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Death bowed his head in scornful, cold assent. The builder of the stream-like earth for man, who has mocked his vanity, all gifts he gave, uplifting his disastrous voice he spoke, indulgent to the dreams my touch shall break, I yield to this blind father's long heart, kingdom and power and friends and greatness lost, and royal trappings for his peaceful dreams, the pallid pomp of man's declining days, the silvery decadent glories of life's fall, to one who wiser grew by adverse fate, should I restore the deluded soul preferred to impersonal nothingness, bare, sublime. The sensuous solace of the light I give to eyes which could have found a larger realm, a deeper vision in their fathomless night. For that this man desired and asked in vain, while still he lived on earth and cherished hope.
Thank you. Satyavan is living in the forest, or was living in the forest, because his father had been exiled from his kingdom. And he'd been exiled, his enemies had been able to drive him out, because he was blind, he became blind. So death says Satyavan has been wishing that his father should have his sight restored, and should be able to resume ruling his kingdom in honor, end his life in that royal state. So that is the gift that he's giving. One of our team, research team, Vladimir, who is no longer with us, no longer working with us, he has done a... He's done a very nice study about these boons and the symbolic meaning of the boons. It's connected with the author's note. Dyumatsena, Lord of the Shining Hosts, that's what his name means. Commander, it's right at the very beginning, the author's note. The author's note, not the publisher's note.
Just before part one. Just before part one page.
There, you got it. Yeah. So this is where he gives the, we could say, even the philological clue which he discovered to the symbolism of this ancient story. That each of these names is meaningful. And the name of Satyavan's father, the king, is Dyumatsena, which he says, Lord of the Shining Hosts, or we could say the commander of the armies of light. He is the father of Satyavan. And Sri Aurobindo says, what he represents is the divine mind in its divine form. Here, in the world of matter, of ignorance and death, has fallen blind, losing its celestial kingdom of vision, its divine power of seeing things as they really are. And through that, he has lost his kingdom of glory, because he's lost his power of vision. He's lost the power to rule with vision, with the vision of the truth. So this is the first boon that through her tapasya, Savitri is getting back, the transformation of the mind into its divine form. Dhyumatsena will get back his sight and his kingdom, his power to rule.
On the lines, I think it's 266, the eyes which could have found a larger realm, a deeper vision in their fathomless night, it almost sounds as if the blindness were an opportunity for deeper knowledge.
That's what death is saying, no? And he says, higher up he said, this is the one who's created this dreamlike earth, and all the gifts he's given, he's made them somehow in vain. So this earthly vision, he says, and this is an ancient tradition, that people who are physically blind have the opportunity to gain a much greater inner vision. So we find it in Greek mythology, the story of Tiresias. You know, physically he's blind, but in his consciousness he can see into the future. He's a prophet. He can see the truth. So here death is all the way through. He says, now I'm giving you something. I'm indulgent. I'm giving according the dreams, but my touch is going to break them anyway. No? I'm yielding all those things that he wanted. The pallid pomps, all the trappings of royalty, but they are so pale and worthless. The silver decadent glories of life's fall, the end of life. To one who grew wiser by adverse fate, by having to leave his kingdom and come and live here in the forest, Dhyumatsena has grown wiser. But now I'm giving back all those possessions and position, all these good things that I will give back. The deluded soul, the soul that is misled, prefers these things, to impersonal nothingness, the sublimity of the supreme state of pure existence. Instead, I will give all these trivial things. And I will give back this comfort to the senses of being able to see the light, to eyes which could, if he'd chosen to stay blind, he could have found a deeper country and a more profound vision in this fathomless night of blindness. So he's mocking his own gifts and pointing out that they're not worth much really, but you can have them, since that's what Satyavan wanted. He's the commander of the army. That's what the divine mind should do. Sri Aurobindo speaks about the rays. The rays should all be in order, like an army, and each should go and do what it has to do. And this is the way in which the law of mind is laid on matter's work, and the soul's wish is gained from earth's inconscient force. We can see that even our imperfect mind does this. We can see that mind can prevail over matter. the mental will can prevail over matter. The only trouble is because we don't have this power of vision, the solutions that mind proposes to us for gaining our will always have some disadvantage, and they create the more problems. They solve one set of problems, and they. So that is why we need to regain that celestial power of vision in order to will according to the truth of things, the inherent truth of things, which doesn't cause any distortion when it gets implemented.
But you might say now is also the part, some part of Schrodinger.
Of course.
For that, I associate this aspect of Schrodinger.
But then is that a power that Savitri is kind of winning back now for humanity?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
As a stepping stone.
Yeah. Yeah. As a potentiality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the first boom. Shall we stop there for today? We can listen to Mother reading some passages from this canto.
The woman first assaulted the abyss, daring to journey through the eternal night, armored with light, she advanced her foot to plunge into the dread and shoeless vacancy. Once more, she heard the treading of a god, and out of the dumb darkness, Satyavan, her husband, grew into a luminous shape. Missing to the night his little call. This is my silent darkening city, entombing the vanity of life's desires. Hast thou beheld thy thoughts, O transient hearts, and known from what the dream thou art was made? At last she spoke, her voice heard by night. I bow not to thee, O huge mask of death, black lion night to the cowed soul of man. Conscious of immortality, I walk. First, I demand whatever Satyavan, my husband, waking in the forest charm, out of his long, pure childhood's lonely dreams, desired and had not, for his beautiful life, give if thou must, or if thou canst fortune. Bowed his head in scornful condescent, uplifting his disastrous rights, he spoke, I yield to his blind father's wrong heart, kingdom and power and friends and greatness lost and royal trapping to his peaceful age, the pallid pomps of man's declining days, the silver decadent glories of life. But Savitri answered the disdainful shape, world spirit, I was thy equal spirit born. I am immortal in my mortality. I tremble not before the immobile gaze of the unchanging marble hierarchies that look with stone eyes of law and faith. My soul can meet them with its living fire, wherever thou leadest him soul, I shall pursue. Against the woman's boundless heart arose the almighty cry of universal death. Hast thou got wings or feet that tread my stars? Frail creature with the courage that aspires, forgetting thy bounds of thought, thy mortal role, I will take from thee the black eternal grip, clasping in thy heart thy fate's ignominious dole, departing peace, if peace for man is just. But Savitri answered, meeting scorn with scorn, the mortal woman to the dreadful Lord. who is this God, imagined by thy knife, contemptuously creating worlds disdained? Who made through vanity the brilliant stars? Not he, who has reared his temple in my soul, and made his sacred floor my human heart. My Lord, these wills and triumphs in his power, my God is love and sweetness of his own. Love's golden wings have power to fan thy voice. The eyes of love gaze star-like through death's night. The feet of love tread naked, hardest word.
Thanks to Shobindal.